What I've put in the board is the way that the Buddha introduces his teaching to really, this encouragement to really study our own minds, to look carefully at our own minds through the eyes, not of judgment and not in blame and not of shame, but through the eyes of discernment, to really examine in our thoughts and our own intentions that are woven into the fabric of our lives, to look at what leads to suffering and what leads to the end of suffering. This discernment foundation is so essential, because without it, we do often just have judgment and blame and shame, or just simply being lost in whatever is predominant thought or intention of the moment. Okay? So the Buddha is very much emphasizing this level of clear seeing, investigation. I mentioned earlier on this morning these four dimensions of what mindfulness is. You know, the Pali word, as you know, is sati, which is a far more nuanced word than mindfulness, particularly the way that mindfulness has become, you know, such common currency in our culture, and often seen as being really rather one-dimensional. Again, mindfulness is one of those words that was introduced by the early translators in the 18th century, and because they couldn't figure out a translation for sati, they borrowed mindfulness from the Gospels, actually, as being the nearest proximity to what they thought the Buddha was talking about. But I mentioned this morning that this word sati has four dimensions, and the first dimension is this simple knowing, you know, this quality of waking up inwardly to simply know the moment as it is. Without the narrative, without the interpretation, without the reactions, to simply know a sound as a sound, a thought as a thought, a body sensation as a body sensation, a mental state as a mental state. And then the second domain of mindfulness very much comes into what I've talked about already this morning, this domain of mindfulness, which is really a quality of investigation. And the Buddha used almost a medical model. Well, he did use a medical model. He likened this domain of mindfulness to a surgeon about to perform an operation. He said if it's a good surgeon, they don't just, you know, run around with a scalpel slashing here and there. They first would probe the nature of the wound to actually determine what the nature of the wound was, to know what suffering is. They would then actually, in that probing, come to know the cause or the origins of the wound in order to make a diagnosis and in order to have a prognosis and a path of treatment. You know, and actually once they discover that the wound is pain, is sorrow, it has origins. That's the diagnosis and the pathology of it, that there is a prognosis, that there is healing possible, and that there is a methodology of treatment, you know, which the Buddha very much described as the path of waking up. So this discernment and this investigation of really clearly knowing, not fooling ourselves, what leads to affliction inwardly and outwardly? What leads away from nirvana? What obstructs wisdom? What leads to nirvana? What clears and develops wisdom? And what actually leads to the end of affliction for ourselves and others? So then we come to the third domain of sati, and I think this is very much in this discourse, where the Buddha uses this word, abandon it. You know, a thought of cruelty, and a thought of cruelty is simply, you know, the wish, consciously or unconsciously, to do harm to another. You know, a thought of ill will, a thought of sensual desire, when it arises, abandon it. Sometimes it might subside just by the knowing of it, but that's no guarantee of its non-arising in the future. What does it mean to abandon it? How would you abandon something? I mean, here we get into the domain of sati, which is really called protective awareness. And the image that is used in the discourses is of a gatekeeper at the city gates. And they're discerning when people come to the gates of the city, is this a person who's of benefit to the city, or is this a person who is not of benefit to the city? And they determine who will be invited to enter and who will not be invited to enter. This is called protective awareness. We actually know on the basis of discernment what serves well and what does not serve well. That doesn't mean those visitors at the city gates don't keep showing up. But then that is protective awareness to actually determine how much we engage with the city, with the visitor at the city gates. Do we offer the unhelpful visitor a glass of water and a knowing acknowledgement, or do we offer them a 5-course meal? If we offer them a 5-course meal, they're likely to return. Think about your afflictive thoughts or your afflictive intentions, you know. Offer them a feast, they'll think this is a good place to hang around, isn't it? We learn actually to not consent, not entertain. That doesn't involve any level of suppression or pushing or aversion. It's based on discernment. I mean, I even think about how this kind of translates into many contemporary mindfulness programs, you know, where always the encouragement to step out of rumination into somatic experience. This is protective awareness. Stepping out of obsession into somatic experience. There's a choice being made in that moment about what we engage with. At other times, it might be stepping out of obsession into the cultivation of metta, of wise attention, taking our attention elsewhere. This is protective awareness. It's not about good, bad, right, wrong. It's about what leads to freedom and what leads away to freedom. What deepens habit and what lessens the habitual nature of our minds. And the fourth dimension of awareness, which actually we come into later on in this discourse, is sometimes has this incredibly awkward translation of cognitive reframing. Cognitive reframing. We're actually changing our view. I mean, you think about this even in terms of sensual desire, when I thought that this was really going to deliver me endless happiness if I just got to this meal. We cognitively reframe that. Yes, it might be delightful, but it's not going to deliver eternal happiness. We reframe this about ourselves also on the basis of what leads to our affliction, the affliction of others, is about so many views we hold about ourselves or hold about other people that have become so reified and so static and so solid when we say you are or I am. It's like a life sentence, isn't it? And in a way, I can think of no greater act of compassion than to liberate other people from our views of them. We might think about this inwardly also. What act of compassion it would be to liberate ourselves from the views that we hold about ourselves, because almost always our self-views are formed around limitation and imperfection, almost invariably. But I had a really classic, I think, example of this, you know, in the recent past when I was eating having dinner in a small restaurant, quite small, you know, maybe only 20 people, and there was this group of very small children playing tag in the restaurant and screaming at the tops of their voices, as you could imagine. Well, you could visualize that, couldn't you? And as the time went on, that the game got wilder and wilder, you know, plates were being knocked off table and the screeching got louder and louder, and you could sort of feel the sort of tenor in the restaurant, the the level of tension and irritation and mumbling and grumbling beginning to rise. And I must say, I wasn't completely exempt myself, but I thought maybe I should check this out. That was mindfulness, right? Maybe I should check this out. So I thought, I wonder where their parents are. And I sort of peered around this short wall in the restaurant where their parents were likely to be sitting. And I saw a group of women all signing to each other. And I just thought, you know, and I could just feel in that moment that shift from this slight irritation to this tremendous sense of allowing and befriending. But what would happen if we don't make that check-in? Just check in whether our views are actually true or correct, or whether we have formed a view based on our own ill will or based upon our own desires. Then the world gets delivered into those views, aren't they? They're bound by those views. So we have to think about how would you abandon that which does not serve you well? How would you abandon it? Not to think, again, to reshape this word abandonment. How would you abandon something, a habit pattern that does not serve you well, based on that discernment that this leads to your affliction or it leads to the inflictions of others? How would you abandon that as it arises and possibly re-arises and re-arises, and we don't know how many times it will re-arise? You know, there isn't a timetable here. You know, there isn't a promise that, you know, I'll do this 30 times and then that's it. You know, what would it be if it was even a year or 10 years of abandoning something that doesn't serve you well? How would you abandon it? That's a question. It's a question. Yeah.
I think investigation could certainly be a path to figure out what's really real.
Yeah, investigation's very much a part of it. The willingness to investigate, because you have to remember we are very often deeply, deeply attached to our ill will. You know? And we're deeply attached to our views, and we're deeply attached to our sensual cravings, even when we know they don't serve us well. We can be so still deeply attached to them. Isn't that perverse? I think I'll just dwell in my feud for another, you know, lifetime. How else would you abandon something? Yeah.
I mean, I tried to put it on the side, that thought, but it still kept coming.
You tried to put it on the side and it still kept coming. So such is the nature of it, because, and I think it's really important not to underestimate this piece, that we can hold this paradox in our minds, you know, this contradiction, that even though we know something doesn't serve us well, we're still hooked. For one reason or another, you know, for one reason or another, we're still hooked. So we, you know, the Buddha would certainly recommend, you know, take your attention elsewhere. Take your attention away from it. You know, we don't know, yes, it might still come. But in that one moment of taking your attention elsewhere, you're engaged in a fasting process. You're not going to feed that particular obsession or that particular tangle. And that moment is worthy. Sometimes the Buddha suggests put your tongue against the roof of your mouth and don't go there. It's a habit. It's a habit. Might be a habit that's got some juice for us, but still a habit. So I want to go on just a little bit, but you might consider that paradox, that contradiction over lunch. How we can be invested in something that doesn't serve us well. So, bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, Whatever a bhikkhuni frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of their mind. If they frequently think and ponder upon thoughts of sensual desire, they have abandoned the thought of renunciation to cultivate the thought of sensual desire. That's really important. If they frequently think and ponder upon thoughts of sensual desire, they have abandoned the thought of renunciation to cultivate the thought of sensual desire. And then their mind inclines to thoughts of sensual desire. If they frequently think and ponder upon thoughts of ill will, upon thoughts of cruelty, they have abandoned the thought of metta to cultivate the thought of cruelty. They have abandoned the thought with the intention of compassion to cultivate the thought of cruelty. And then their mind inclines to thoughts of cruelty. What we are talking here is the process of habit building, a psychological and emotional habit building. That what we frequently think about and ponder upon will become the inclination of our mind. But what is so important here is actually the incompatibility of these two strands. That if we ponder upon and dwell upon thoughts of ill will, we have abandoned the intention of metta. We have abandoned the intention of compassion. If we frequently think and dwell upon thoughts of sensual desire, we have abandoned the thoughts of unbinding. It's so important to acknowledge that in the world of habit building. And it doesn't really feel like a choice, does it? Because only in the presence of mindfulness is there actually a choice. And much of what this is going on in the landscape of a slight amount of confusion, but being aware that every time there's that shift towards that thinking and pondering upon ill will or cruelty or sensual desire, we have abandoned, we have disconnected from metta, compassion, and unbinding. What does it mean to think about and ponder upon a thought of ill will? How do we do that? We tell the story. We repeat the story, and we repeat it again. And we wake up the next morning, and we repeat it again. You have injured me, you have hurt me, you have this kind of person. We form a view of that person. The stronger that view is directly related to strengthening the degree of ill will and estrangement. We think about and ponder upon. We can even convince ourselves this is a good thing to do, you know. That we're trying to figure this out, you know? Or we're trying to explain it, or we're trying to justify how we feel. So we will think about it and ponder about it even more. And what happens when we think about it and ponder about it and dwell upon? Doesn't it just become more defined, more solidified? And doesn't the sense of injury and harm also become solidified and reified? Basically, what happens in thinking about and pondering upon and dwelling upon is that we are turning process into state. We are turning verbs into nouns. We say, this is how I feel about you. This is how you are. This is how I feel about myself. This is how I am. To this, our mind will incline. We're sowing the seeds of the next bout of ill will. We sow the seeds of the next bout of harshness. We sow the seeds of the next bout of clinging, because this is talking about the process of building psychological and emotional habits. Is that ring true for you? I mean, can we see this? Can we see the difficulty, the entangling that comes in? And within it, and it's so important to see that the solidification of a sense of injury is directly related to the reification of that person who is like this, the person who has injured me. There is an interruption of process. It's a kind of a death, I think, because it comes to a place of that is static, that is flat, that is one-dimensional, that has little possibility of change. Do we see that it leads to our affliction? So, good moment for a pause. Anyone have anything they'd like to add? Yes. Well, let's take it. I mean, it's good. I mean, ill will, that's hardly a compound word that we would use very much in English. It's a spectrum word, you know, so it includes aversion, irritation, vexation, jealousy, resentment, frustration, hatred, shame, guilt, resistance, denial. We could go on. That's ill will, okay? So it's a spectrum word, from the very minor vexations, impatience, irritation, to the really big, I can't bear this, and I really want this to be annihilated or erased in some way. Cruelty, you know, when we think of cruelty, that also feels like a very potent word, but it is actually much more on the level that it's really an extension of that aversion, that actually, or that ill will, that actually through how I see you or through how I see myself, I actually move more towards harmfulness. And that could be like really harsh speech, condemning speech that harms. It could be much more subtle in terms of shutting people out of our lives, ignoring, neglecting. It could be directed inwardly in a constant kind of infliction of, you know, of self-hatred. It could even be in what is very more and more common in our world, self-harming. You know, and self-harming, whether it's, you know, whether through cutting or substance abuse, or, you know, so cruelty in this sense is much more actually the extension of will that actually does cause harm. And much of that, of course, is not because we get up in the morning wanting to be murderous or anything like that. It is often so quick a reactivity. I mean, first of all, the word desire is a little bit tricky, you know, because, I mean, first of all, in Buddhist psychology, there are 16 different words for desire in Pali. And some of these are extremely wholesome. You know, the desire that gets you here this morning, you know, the desire to create, the desire to care, the desire to be awake. Many of these are extremely wholesome desires. They're chanda, no ennobling desires, and very necessary for a creative and awakened life. They're also, sensual desire is very different than sensual appreciation. So here we're getting into tanha, into this domain of sensual craving. Sensual craving. Now, the nature of that, to distinguish it very clearly, is its compulsion, its compulsive nature, its entangled nature, the fact that it pushes us habitually, often, and unconsciously towards the pursuit of the pleasant and the avoidance of the unpleasant. So the craving for sensual desire in Buddhist teaching is used in this very, very specific way. This is a compulsion. It's a compulsion that's rooted in a sense of insufficiency. It's a compulsion that leads us to externalize the sources of happiness. And it's a compulsion that pushes us through life in fear and agitation. Very, very different from the ennobling, skillful desires and the appreciation of sensual pleasure. Does that answer? Okay, thank you. Sensual craving. It is almost helpful, although I think it's also good to unpack the word desire. I think it's good if it leads to that question, you know, because again, I think there's such a tendency, particularly in Western practice, to have a sort of blanket condemnation of desire, you know, as being always offensive and always incorrect. You know, whereas here we are actually speaking about that which entangles us in affliction. And compulsion entangles us in affliction because there's no freedom in compulsion. And there's often, you know, such deeply rooted ideologies that underlie the pursuit of sensual desire and sensual craving. Yeah. Yes, please. Yeah, it is. It is very challenging to, given our cultural messages, to seek outwardly for pleasure, satisfaction, identity, to have that shift. However, you know, we have to recognize, you know, in the Western world, depression is the leading cause of life quality reducing desire illnesses. You know, that, you know, one in four of us is going to suffer clinical depression in our life. You know, it's become the leading cause of illness in the developing world. We live in a disappointed culture, I regret to say. You know, we live in a culture where actually, yes, we absorb all those messages of just get more, become more, have more, and you'll be happy. And we live in a culture where, you know, what is the biggest trigger of depression? Unexpected loss. And sometimes it's the unexpected loss of our ideologies that I should be happier than I am. You know, so I do feel like there is, although it may not be so apparent, I do feel that there is, to some extent, you know, a quality of waking up in our world, where there is a re-examination of what we mean by happiness and where it's found, you know, and what we mean by freedom and where it's found. And I do feel in some ways the sort of epidemic of mental health problems in our world has been something of a trigger for that questioning. So yes, it is. It's a hard one to question, but I think many people to question this.